Hi, this is Stanley Bronstein, the founder of SuperChangeYourLife.com. Welcome to another in our ongoing series of interviews titled, How One Person Can Change the World. In this series, we're interviewing people who have not only taken action to change their life, but who have then gone on to use their ideas, passion, and energy to change the lives of others. Today, we're interviewing Sonia Pressman Fuentes. Sonia is an American author, speaker, feminist leader, and lawyer. She was born in Berlin, Germany, of Polish parents with whom she came to the U.S. to escape the Holocaust. In the U.S., she became one of the founders of the second wave of the women's movement. She was a founder of the National Organization for Women, NOW, and Federally Employed Women, FEW, and was the first woman attorney in the Office of the General Counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Ms. Fuentes is the author of a memoir, Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter, which has been required reading at Cornell University and American University in Washington, D.C. Her articles on women's rights and other subjects have been published in newspapers, magazines, and journals in the U.S. and throughout the world. Sonia has given talks throughout the U.S., as well as in Germany, Spain, Japan, China, the Philippines, Singapore, Indonesia, and Thailand. Currently, she is a community and feminist activist, writer, and public speaker. Sonia, welcome to Super Change Your Life. How are you doing today?
I'm just fine, and it's nice to be with you.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to do this interview. To start off, could you take a few minutes and tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to start the incredible journey you've been on for a number of years? And I know you have such a long story, asking you to do it in a few minutes is a pretty hard task, but please do the best you can.
You'll have to be more specific because you asked me to tell about my background and about the founding of NOW. And that's a very long story. Could you be more specific or narrow your question down a little bit?
Okay. Specifically, how did you come about, let's start back a little bit earlier. How did you become a lawyer in the first place? Yes, but that was back at a time when not as many women were going to law school, am I correct?
That is correct. In 1957, which is the year that I graduated from law school, 3% of the nation's law school graduates were women.
Now it's over 50%, I believe.
Well, it's around 50%. I don't know the exact figure, but it's certainly, well, the law school students are about 50% women. I don't know what the percentage is of graduates, probably a little bit less.
Okay. And were people surprised when you first decided to go to law school?
Absolutely. My parents and everybody else who knew me was shocked because women didn't go to law school in those days. You know, it's as if I'm trying to think of some weirdo occupation that if I said, perhaps if we've had women astronauts, so that doesn't do it. But if there were some occupation that nobody ever heard of a woman doing today, and if some woman announced that she was going to do that, you would get that kind of a reaction. Everybody was just very surprised.
And yet you did it anyway.
Also suggested that I not do it.
To me, that says something about your personality. How did you respond to people when they suggested to you that you not go to law school?
Well, it took me quite a while and a lot of thought to make the decision to go to law school. But I'm somebody that, while I may have trouble making a decision, once I make it, I really don't care what anybody else thinks about it.
That's probably a good way to live life, because I know I've found myself, if we always try to make decisions based upon what other people tell us, we would be limiting ourselves quite a bit. And obviously, it's a good thing that you chose, that you were determined, and you stuck with your guns on that, because you went quite a bit away after that. How did you start, when you graduated from law school, did you find it hard to find a job as a lawyer?
I wouldn't have had I looked for a job in private practice, but what happened to me was that professor at the law school, the University of Miami School of Law, called me one day, and by the way, I had never taken a course with her. And she told me that people from the federal government in Washington were recruiting at my law school, and she asked me if I'd seen the notice. And I said I had, but I had no interest in going to work in Washington, D.C., because my family and I had always driven through Washington, D.C. on our way to spend the winters in Miami Beach, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Struck me as a large city full of gray buildings, and I assumed anonymous people would be toiling in offices in those buildings, and it didn't seem attractive to me. So I told the professor, whose name was Manette Massey, that I saw the notice, but I wasn't interested in working for the federal government. And she said, well, I thought you should go, and I've made an appointment for you at 2 o'clock on Friday.
That was nice of her.
Changed my life, and I never talked to her or to anybody who knows her without telling this story. And so I went to that interview, and then I went to another interview when other federal agency people came down, and both agencies offered me a job, and I took a job with my first job was with the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Alien Property. Later on in my career, I tried to get a job in private practice, and I discussed this in my memoir, and I really could not. So the federal government was hiring women in this is 1957, the federal government was hiring women lawyers in those days. It wasn't promoting them equally with men, but it was hiring them, which is something that corporations and private law firms basically were not doing. If they were hiring women lawyers, then they would hire them for specific types of jobs where they wouldn't be meeting with clients.
So the federal government was a little bit ahead of the curve at that time.
Absolutely.
Okay, but they weren't so ahead of the curve to offer equal opportunity, but that's something I imagine that would come later, and that would give you future projects to work on. So as you were going through the government, you progressed to other agencies. I believe it was in 1963 or 1964, was it not, when a lot of the civil rights and the women's rights issues were starting to come to the forefront?
The first federal agency that got authority to administer a law involving gender discrimination was the Labor Department, which got the authority to implement the Equal Pay Act of 1963, which became effective in 1964. And then the second act was Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 1965. That second act was administered by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, and I went to work for that agency 3 months after it opened for business.
Can you, I was reading a little bit from your memoirs about how you came to work at the EEOC. It sounded like an interesting story. Could you share that with us a little bit, please?
Oh, I'd be happy to. From the age of 10, I'd always felt that my life had been saved because there was something I needed to do. There were various reasons in things in my life that led me to that conclusion. One of them was, of course, that my life was saved from the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always had this feeling that I was not free to just live a normal life and get married and have children, but that there was something I was meant to do. But I had no idea what it was. But because of that feeling, I was always looking for that job which would put me in the place where I could do what I was supposed to do. So whatever job I had, at some point I was always looking for the next one. And there was a trial examiner at the National Labor Relations Board where I was working. And he liked women. So he was frequently having lunch with me and holding out the carrot that he could introduce me to people to get me another job. But while we had lunches, he never came through on any job leads. So one time I was talking to a friend of mine, Jackie Williams, who's a friend of mine to this day, who also worked at the National Labor Relations Board, and she knew this trial examiner. And one time I'd had lunch with her, with him, and she said to me, "What's doing? How are you?" And I said, "I had just had another one of those lunches, which didn't produce any job leads." And she said, "Oh, if you want another job, why don't you go across the street to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission? They've just opened for business. And a former law professor of mine, Charlie Duncan, is the first general counsel. Why don't you ask him for a job?" So I called the EEOC, and I made an appointment to see Charlie Duncan, the general counsel. And when I walked into his office, he swept his arm over his desk, and he said to me, "You see all these papers on my desk?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Those are all applications for the one job I have here." And then he said, "I don't know why, but I'm going to hire you." So that's how I got hired at the EEOC.
Well, I would think you had a lot of, I mean, the fact that you had a lot of experience already in the government, that would help. And you were obviously a hard worker, that would also help. And I guess he also had instinct. So what was it like once you started at the EEOC? I would imagine that was a very interesting time, I mean, to be in the mid-60s, right in the middle of all this when it was just starting to happen.
Well, it's interesting when you look back on it, but when you're living it, it was actually quite difficult.
Oh, I imagine so.
First of all, we had a very small staff at the general counsel's office. There were there was the general counsel, the deputy general counsel, a junior attorney, and I. And the general counsel, Charlie Duncan, didn't have any particular views on gender discrimination. It wasn't an issue yet until all this happened. But he was educable. The deputy general counsel, a guy named Dick Berg, had very old-fashioned views, and he thought woman's place was in the home. So, and he had married a woman from a foreign country, and she stayed home, and so this was his idea of how women should live. But on a larger scale, it was difficult because Title VII was passed as a result of the civil rights movement. And there were about 100 permanent employees at the EEOC during those early days, and most of them had come there to fight employment discrimination based on race or color.
Okay.
So the prohibition against gender discrimination did not come into the bill until the latter stages of the debate, and it wasn't included among the prohibited bases of discrimination in employment. But towards the latter part of the debate, Howard Smith, a congressman from Virginia who was opposed to the civil rights bill, introduced an amendment to also prohibit gender discrimination in employment. And his motivations for doing that are complicated, and no one's exactly sure, because I could talk about 10 or 15 minutes on what his motivations might have been.
Mm-hmm.
That as it may, he introduced that amendment. He subsequently voted against the bill, but he introduced that amendment, and I guess nobody was going to get up from the Congress and say, we don't want sex discrimination to be included. However, there were women, Esther Peterson, famous woman famous woman, and Mary Kaiserling, head of the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor, who worked down the hill to get it taken out. They thought that gender discrimination should be a separate law, and they didn't want it included in Title VII. But the Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray, who wasn't a reverend at that time, an African-American feminist writer, PhD, lawyer, she fought to keep gender discrimination in, and it stated, so the act was passed with a prohibition against employment discrimination based on sex. Well, there were two problems with that. First of all, as I mentioned, most of the people at the commission were there to fight employment discrimination based on race or color.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want the commission's time and money diverted to issues of gender discrimination. And the second problem was that there hadn't been a women's movement immediately prior to the passage of Title VII, as there had been a movement for civil rights for African Americans. So gender discrimination hadn't been a subject of debate in the country, and nobody at the commission really knew how to implement the provisions of the act as it applied to gender discrimination. There were serious questions of interpretation involved. So because of those two reasons, for about the first year, the commissioners did not really deal with issues of gender discrimination. And I was right there on the spot, and I saw this, and I was increasingly frustrated by it.
So how did you handle it? What happened after that? I mean, I can understand how you would be frustrated. So what did you and obviously other people around you decide to do about that?
Well, one day, a woman came into the office of the general counsel. She had written a book in 1963 called The Feminine Mystique, and her name was Betty Friedan. And she thought she was going to write a second book about all the progress she thought women had made since the publication of The Feminine Mystique. And she was going to interview my boss, the general counsel, and his deputy. But she saw me in the office, a woman. So she came over to me and she said, "What are the problems here? What are the conflicts? What's going on?" And I felt that if I told her what was going on, that I could lose my job.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Nothing. Everything's just wonderful here." So then she came a couple of weeks later a second time. And she happened to come into the office at a time when I was terribly frustrated with the agency's failure to implement the law for women. So I invited her into the privacy of my office, and with tears rolling down my eyes, I told her about my frustration, and I told her that what this country needed was an organization to fight for women like the NAACP fought for its constituency. And then in June of 1966 and in October of 1966, there were two meetings at which NOW was formed. And NOW's primary purpose at that time, it had other purposes, but its primary purpose was to get the EEOC to enforce the law for women.
Did you wind up losing your job over this, or did things evolve?
No. I never had a problem with losing my job or anything like that. At one point, the vice chairman of the commission, a man named Luther Holcomb, who was definitely not favorable to women's rights, asked my boss, the general counsel, Charlie Duncan, to remove me from the assignment of writing the first and the lead decision in the case involving airline stewardesses, because he said I was prejudiced. By prejudiced, he meant that I was in favor of women's rights. To him, that was prejudiced. But Charlie Duncan paid no attention to him, and I wrote that decision. But otherwise, I never experienced what's the word I'm looking for?
Negative repercussions.
Any negative results from my having spoken to Betty, and I don't even know if anybody knew that I spoke to her.
I would think it would have been pretty difficult if you would have gotten fired over something like that. It would have created a really huge storm of controversy, because the very agency that was formed to stop things like that happening couldn't very well fire you over that. But it would have been That would have been a very interesting phase of history had that happened.
I don't know, because women's rights was not a big deal in those days. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is a small agency. I don't know that anything would have happened as a result of it, but it didn't happen.
Well, that's fortunate. So what happened once NOW was formed? Tell us what the early days of that was like.
Well, I was mostly involved as a founder of NOW, and of course, well, several things were going on. One, I was a founder of NOW. Two, I was working at the OC, and whenever any issue came up with regard to interpretation of the law, I always raised the question about how would this affect women. And so my boss, Charlie Duncan, took to calling me a sex maniac because I always raised the women's issue. Once NOW was formed, all kinds of things began to happen. NOW was very active. Filed lawsuits, it picketed the White House, it protested, it got publicity, and things began to turn around because of that activity and because of NOW's shining a bright light on the EOC's failure to enforce the law for women. So things turned around.
I would think NOW, while the battle was not easy, I would think the very fact that approximately 50% of the people in the United States are women, whereas African Americans, you know, it's not 50%, it's much less than that. I would think that just, you know, helped. I mean, there were so many people to get on board that it would just, you know, swell from there, because I mean women are a large segment of our population.
Well, women are the majority of our population, but I don't agree with your reasoning. What produces change is apparently not the number of people being discriminated against, but the number who do something about it.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that. You're absolutely correct.
Before NOW was founded, we also had plenty of women in the United States, but they were not protesting about their being second-class citizens.
No, but I mean, once you got it started, is what I'm saying, you had a larger pool of affected people to draw from.
Even then, it took quite a while
to bring it
to the consciousness of the women. NOW was founded by 49 men and women. That's a small number of people to affect change in a country which, I don't know what the population was then, maybe over 200 million, it's over 300 million now. It was really a small group. But I think Margaret Mead is the one that said, in order to affect change, all you need is a small group of dedicated people working together. And that's my experience.
Well, that's
changes
usually
didn't happen because women were in majority even after NOW was formed. But after NOW was formed, little by little, and it took a long time, this country, in surveys, showed that the country began to be in favor of women's rights, not just women, the country. But that took quite a while.
Do you feel like the battle has been won, or do you feel like the battle is still ongoing as we speak?
Well, both of those are true. Certainly, the battle has not been won. I gave a speech at Cornell last October about the legal revolution and women's rights in this country and the problems that remain. And at the end of my talk, I listed just some of the remaining major problems in the United States, and there were over 20. And then I listed another 10 that are problems for women in the rest of the world. So on the one hand, the changes that I have been lucky enough to live to see are way beyond what those of us who founded NOW expected to happen. We really were just focusing on the EOC doing its job with regard to women. We were focusing on getting women hired equally with men and promoted equally with men, and we were focusing on women's being taken into colleges and universities, being admitted to colleges and universities and to graduate school. equally with men. Those are really the three things we were focusing on. We didn't think that these changes in the employment status of women would spill over into every single aspect of American life and change it. But we didn't have any such grandiose objectives. So the changes that have happened in the last almost 50 years are remarkable, astounding, way beyond anything we expected. On the other hand, the changes that remain to be dealt with are huge, and the fight is not won, and young women and men today are continuing, and some of us from the past are continuing, and it goes on.
First of all, I want to say thank you for the hard work that you and many others did back then, because I feel like my generation, which was the generation that came after yours, benefited and has benefited and continues to benefit quite a bit from the hard work that you did and continue to do. So I want to say thank you. And the second thing I want to ask you is, what are some of the issues that you see in the future that need to be addressed? I mean, I guess what I'm asking you is, what would you like to see happen in the future?
Well, with regard to your thanking me, I appreciate that. People are always thanking me, and it's very nice, but I wasn't doing anything for anybody else. I just saw what appeared to me a huge inequity, and I couldn't step away from it without trying to do something about it. And I happened to be in an agency where I was in a position to do something about it, but it wasn't in my mind, oh, I'm going to do somebody a favor out there, or I'm going to help some women, I don't even know who they are. No, it was, this wasn't right. And I'm somebody that when I see something that isn't right, I try to do something about it, either by myself or generally getting other people to work with me. Now, as to what are the problems that I see today, I wish I had my speech in front of me, but I will tell you what I can remember, and not necessarily in the order of importance. Violence against women is a worldwide problem. The issue of sexual assaults and rapes in the military in the United States and elsewhere where we have military serving, and this affects both men and women, it is increasing in the United States, not getting better. And the military has not sufficiently grappled and dealt with this problem. We do not have enough women in the federal government, in the legislature, in the Congress. Currently, the percentage is about 17% of women in the Senate and women in the House. We have a population that's over 50% female, so that's a big problem. We also don't have enough women in positions such as mayor and governor and in the state legislatures. Conditions for women in prison and jails are pretty bad. They get attacked and sexually abused both by other prisoners and by guards, and they don't have adequate medical facilities. And the root causes of what put them in prison is very often systemic, having to do with things like drug addiction and abuse in their own families. These things are not dealt with sufficiently in the rest of the world, and to some extent also in the United States. We still have female genital mutilation, which is a horror. In the rest of the world, we have so-called honor killings. We have young girls are married off to older women. They may be 7 years old, married off to men in their 20s or even older. We have infanticide of female fetuses. I could go on and on. Oh, poverty is especially a women's problem. HIV/AIDS affects a great many women. I could go on teenage pregnancy. I could go on and on and on.
Well, as so many things in life, it is a never-ending battle, and so we continue to move forward, but we have come a long way, and hopefully we will continue to go move forward. I personally am a believer in the power of change, and I believe that we can do anything that we've set our mind to, and I think it's important that people like you speak up, which you have obviously done in the past and obviously continue to do to this present day. And I think that's very important, and I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. In closing, is there any one last thing you would like to speak about or any advice that you would like to share with the people who are listening or any inspiration, any message, whatever?
Well, I would say that men and women in this country need to be aware of the laws that are out there that prohibit gender discrimination of various kinds. I've already mentioned the Equal Pay Act, the Title VII, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which amended Title VII, the Family Medical and Leave Act. There's a lot of laws out there. Just this morning, I answer questions on a website called experts.com, I believe it is, where people ask me questions of gender discrimination. And this morning I got one from a woman who was terminated from her job, I believe, because she was a single mother, and asking me whether she had any rights and what she might do. So people are not sufficiently aware, even though almost 50 years have passed since some of these laws became effective, people need to find out what laws are out there already that they could take advantage of, and how to file complaints under those laws with agencies, or whether they want to hire an attorney or so on. They also need to be aware that there are risks in filing complaints. Even though it's against the law, their employer can retaliate against them, and so these are significant questions. I would also suggest that people interested in women's rights should join organizations that work in these areas. There are a number of such organizations we've mentioned now, which is probably the outstanding one. The American Association of University Women also works in this area. UN Women works in the international area to help women. And so there are a good many such organizations, and you can get a lot done working together with like-minded people. And I suggest that those who care about this issue get involved.
Thank you. I think that's some excellent advice, and I hope that your story will inspire many people to do that, and not just women, men also.
Absolutely. Men were among the founders of NOW and remain active members of NOW.
Well, thank you very much for this interview. I appreciate your time. Have a nice day.
Thank you. The same to you, Stan.